You know, year after year, people make New Year's resolutions, right? Oh, this, I'm going to stop smoking, I'm going to lose weight, and then what happens? Second week of January, don't ask me about my resolutions. You go, what? Yeah, don't ask me. Well, you don't look like you've lost any weight, and you're still puffing away like a chimney. I said, don't ask me. See, but it was a resolution. Our guest is one of our favorites. Akram Alashari is back. Every year, people are faced with the same dilemma. They make resolutions. They don't keep them. Akram, why is that? What is it, just intimidating, the fact that you've promised it to yourself and the pressure of it is too much to bear? Or do we pick resolutions that are such big undertakings, there's no way you can just pivot away from smoking or being overweight or whatever the big change is that you want to make?
Thanks so much for having me, Ed. I think the reason that people don't, you know, are ineffective with their resolutions is because they're actually approaching the whole situation incorrectly.
Mm.
So, for example, if you have a resolution to quit smoking or to quit overeating, it's very hard to command your brain to not do something. Our brains are designed to achieve things, to go after things, not to avoid doing things. So what happens is you command your brain not to do something, and then now you're just facing the temptation constantly. It's just a perpetual temptation, and then it's almost no surprise that within a short period of time you break down and give in to that temptation, particularly if it's a habit you've been having for years and years.
So what's the right way to do it if, in fact, you want to make one of these changes? How do you resolve and stay resolved on something that's an important and maybe a difficult goal?
Well, one thing is, like you said, you've got to set a goal. So it's got to be something that's tangible that you want, that you can take action towards achieving. So it's something that you're moving toward, not something that you're moving away from. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you want to get rid of a habit that you have, whether it's smoking or overeating, then instead of just trying to quit the habit, you have to replace it with something else. So every time you have the temptation to smoke, that sets off a trigger, and that trigger for smoking gives you that temptation. But just put something in place of it, whether it's running, walking, doing some sit-ups, making a phone call, doing push-ups, whatever it is. Do something to replace that urge until you can make that consistent.
But doesn't it have to be something that's equally pleasurable? I mean, smoking, people enjoy it. They like it. They have their favorite brand of cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera. They love a cup of coffee and then that cigarette that goes after it. Don't you have to, you know, if you try to say to them, all right, look, here's how you're going to quit smoking. When you have your coffee in the morning, I want you to go out for a run. After you have the coffee, they'd be like, what, are you crazy? I don't want to run. I hate running. Aren't we going to have to find something that does the pleasure effect? Same thing with eating, right? You got all these people that eat for comfort, right? They're upset. They eat. They're getting the endorphins get going when they taste the cherry pie or the cheesecake at the diner. It sets off all these, oh my God, I love this. Don't you have to find something you absolutely love to replace it with?
You've got to find something that you like that you replace it with. But also, you know, a lot of people who smoke will tell you that they didn't particularly enjoy smoking the first time they had a cigarette. You know, they probably thought it was awful. But over time, it becomes a habit. The same thing with exercising. A lot of people who start exercising are miserable, and it's painful, and they're short of breath, and they're sweating, and all this type of stuff, until the point they get to the point where they actually enjoy exercise.
Right.
So that's one thing. So you've got to understand from the get-go that you may not particularly like this thing that you do in the beginning, but eventually you will like it, just like you like that cherry pie, just like you like those cigarettes. You'll eventually like it, except the difference is that this thing that you like is also beneficial to your health and to your well-being.
So that's kind
and
of
the
interesting.
Second thing,
oh,
yeah,
go ahead. Yes, no, give me the second thing, because I think it's interesting what you just said, but go ahead, the second point.
Well, I was going to say the second thing is that when you're quitting this habit, you also have to consciously remind yourself of all the negative side effects of it, of all the reasons that you don't like smoking. Because even people who do like smoking or do like eating, they will admit that there's a lot of bad things about it. I mean, you feel horrible after you overeat, your stomach's all bloated, or, you know, when you're smoking, you smell bad and all this type of stuff. But we tend to kind of trivialize those things. Instead, intensify those feelings and remember those and put those in the forefront of your consciousness.
Got it. Now, the interesting thing I thought I heard you say is, you know, you may not like the beginning of the good habit you want to adopt, but you know it's for your own good. And you have to remind yourself that, hey, you know what, even if I'm not enjoying these sit-ups this morning, I'll tell you, it's going to be great when I drop the weight and I've got more energy and I've got more strength and I'm healthier. Well, you know, it occurs to me that we have been saying to people in the popular culture for years now, the thing that's right for you will feel right when you do it. You'll know it's the right thing because it feels right. It matches with who you are. How tough is it to discern when we should suffer for something and when something is causing suffering because it's really not consonant with who we are?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that also is related to comfort zones. So, I mean, in order to get better at anything, in order to improve our lives, you know, you've got to be a little bit outside of your comfort zone. If you're consistently within that comfort zone where you don't want to feel the pain of pushing yourself to the next level, you're never going to get any better. So knowing that it's going to be a little difficult and you may not like it initially, it's like being comfortable with being uncomfortable, knowing that this is stretching you, that it's growing you, that's how that you can only, you know, get better by pushing against resistance. You can only get stronger in
right.
the face of resistance.
Right. No, I mean, I hear you loud and clear on that because that's what we were raised with. When I was born in the 50s and was young in the 60s, and that was always a predominant thing. I worry that today's kids, certainly kids the ages of, you know, now I don't even know if they're millennials anymore, but the kids that are under 15, you really don't see any willingness to be uncomfortable at all. And we were uncomfortable at the age of 7 and 8, second, third grade. We were doing things that we may not have enjoyed in the moment, but we were told were good for us, exercise, et cetera, et cetera. It's tough unless you have the proper reinforcement for that you don't wind up adverse to discomfort. To your own detriment, right?
Exactly. And that change in culture, that change in mindset between the young generation now and then the young generation then, it's reflected in the data. I mean, look, the rate of suicide is going up, especially amongst young people. The rate of obesity is going up. And we're becoming more and more affluent as a society, and life is more comfortable.
Right.
But yet we're having all these other maladies.
Hey, listen, you know, I so see the same data. I mean, my personal thing is I think American parents have abandoned their children. I just think they divorce all the time. They have three sets of kids. They move them around on Tuesday and Wednesday to do homework. I just don't think American parenting is worth much anymore. I don't know that parents spend time parenting. It's just a title to brag about for cocktails. But that's me. That's what I'm thinking. Let's talk about your book, The Power of Peak State, which we've talked about before, and your upcoming program, Peak Performing Parents, How to Get Your Children to Achieve Straight A's. Let's talk about that a little bit.
So I created the program because, you know, as a trauma surgeon, I get a lot of patients that come in that are teenagers, that are young, and you know, I'm doing life-saving surgery on them, whether it's, you know, they're bleeding from a violent, you know, activity they were involved in, or reckless behavior, whether it's texting and driving or drinking and driving or whatever it is. And I realize that, you know, as I'm repairing them, helping them, and getting them out of the hospital, unless I really change their mindset, I'm not really helping them. Their behavior is going to stay the same, and they're just going to come back to the hospital with another life-threatening or limb-threatening injury. And so I've spoken to a lot of, you know, my patients, you know, the ones who have survived, and their parents, and I realize a lot of these teenagers, you know, get into these accidents because of peer pressure and because they don't have real goals. They don't know what they want to do with their lives. They don't know what their future looks like. So I created this program to help parents help their kids excel academically. because ultimately I think education is what's going to liberate them and really going to, you know, help them improve their lives. So I talk about goal setting, you know, how to motivate your children, how to find where their talents are, what their drive is, and help them excel so that, number one, they can be successful, and number two, they can, you know, avoid all of these problems that I see when they come to me in the emergency room.
Talk to me a little bit about mentoring. And, you know, it's a word that might be a little bit overused, but you do it, and you do it for people. You're a relatively young guy. You got your MD and everything so young. What is the value of the mentoring process that you see? Where do you see it succeed best in the mentoring that you do?
I think the first thing is, instead of learning from your own mistakes, you can learn from the mistakes of others, so you don't have to make those mistakes.
Nice.
So it's not just trial and error. I mean, we've got those that have came before us, and they can just show us the clear path, number one. And number two, in terms of reaching your goals, I think that you can, you know, you can be faster with a master. You've got to be with someone that's already been there, done that, knows kind of the science of success and of achievement, and can show you the path and then expedite it for you. So you're not struggling or you're frustrated. It makes it a lot easier to reach your goals with a mentor.
And what is it that makes a mentor an effective mentor? Now that you've been one and you've seen success, to what do you attribute that?
It comes down to knowing the person you're mentoring, really developing that connection, knowing what it is that they want. If they could have their ideal life, what would that look like? And then structuring your day-to-day patterns, your habits, your thought processes, structuring them so that it's consistent with this ideal image of your life, so that you can ultimately have the life that you want to have, that you've created.
Akram Alashari, if you go to the website www.thepowerofpeakstate.com, you can connect with him directly. Increase positive energy with your team members. How to become a peak performer. How to raise your standards. How to increase recruitment, retention, especially in small business where you can think you got somebody and just when they're doing it great, they leave you. How to hold on to them. This is really exciting stuff. What are some of the things that you hope to achieve in 2017 as we look forward to the new year?
You know, I'm consistently working on, you know, my goals, keeping myself physically fit, because I think it's easy to lose momentum. You know, one thing is momentum and keeping that momentum. And then I continue to create products, mentor more people, really expand my reach, go to bigger audiences, and help more people.
Right on. I'll tell you what, you know, it's so encouraging for us to hear after all that you've achieved so young and how you really are on a mission to share it with people. It's good to hear that even you have to be conscious of your momentum and not to let inertia set in. And I congratulate you on all the success that you've had. You know, you're such a good guest. We love having you on because you've achieved so much. But it sounds like really your entire focus now is sharing with other people. You got a great quote on the website from John Quincy Adams. If your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, you are a leader. And it sounds like you are. That sounds like what you do. It sounds like he was thinking about you when he wrote it, even though that was a couple hundred years ago. All right, listen, have great holidays, will you? Enjoy all of the frivolity of the season, and we look forward to having you back with us in 2017. Great visit.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You got it. The Power of Peak State. .com. Our guest, an incredible achiever who is now on a mission to show you how to manifest your greatness, Akram Alashari, on the Ed Till Show, Starcom Radio Network. Let's get you caught up with local news, weather, Wall Street, sports, all of that. Then we'll be back.